Today on Wings, an Egyptian journalist who was in on the start of United Nations Radio. This is from the archives.
May I tell you a fairy story? Long, long ago, many, many years ago, somewhere far away in the sands of time, there was a factory for war in a place called Lake Success. And in the same factory, a group of crazy people from something like 45 countries decided to build a factory for peace. And that factory for peace they called the United Nations. And as one delegate grumbled into his beard, it isn't a lake and it isn't a success. Well, it isn't a lake. And whether it's a success or not is a matter of opinion, but it has lasted for 60 years this year.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The woman who opened our show is Lila Doss. Doss spoke about her adventures at the Factory for Peace this fall when women from around the world came together in Williamsburg, Virginia, for the biennial conference of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, or IAWRT. The organization was founded shortly after World War II and has served as a network bringing together women in the broadcast media for more than half a century. IAWRT members come together at conferences to discuss a wide array of issues, ranging from new technologies to improve their work, to breaking down gender barriers, reporting under fire and in conflict zones, and addressing local and international health issues. While IAWRT does not explicitly refer to itself as a feminist organization, its members work to improve the position of women around the world by giving voice to voices that might not otherwise be heard, and by standing as leaders and role models for the next generation of women, not only in the broadcast media, but also those who participate in and are audiences for the work produced. Lila Doss is IAWRT's longest-standing member. With more than 60 years of experience in public information, Doss was not only one of the first members of IAWRT, but also the first Egyptian woman broadcaster and program director at Egyptian State Radio, and one of the first employees in the United Nations Department of Public Information. Within the United Nations, Doss rose to the position of Assistant Secretary General for Personnel Services, and was the first and only one of three women at the UN to achieve this rank. In addition to her many professional achievements, Lila serves as a role model and mentor to many. Her gift for storytelling, her knowledge of history and politics, her sense of fairness and warm chuckle, all make her a compelling matriarch and source of wisdom. It is said that Doss rarely speaks about her achievements unless pressed to do so. And so it was a real pleasure for this reporter to hear Ms. Doss recount her journey from Egyptian State Radio to the United States, and finally to the United Nations, at this fall's IAWRT conference.
Thank you very much. I just thought you might be amused because I've been around in this field for something like 60 years, and the early days of the UN were particularly interesting when this whole question of public information was being decided, and I was in there at the very beginning. But before that, I thought you might be amused to know, because most of my life has been decided by things that happened by chance and by my saying no. I managed to say no to a lot of things, and that's made me move from one thing to another. First of all, how I got into radio was an amusing thing. I didn't plan to get into radio at all, but it was during the war, and I was supposed to go to Oxford, and I was supposed to continue my studies, and of course I couldn't travel during the war. And I happened to be at a dinner party with a very handsome young Englishman who was working for Egyptian State Radio. By then it was already Egyptian State Radio. And he said to me, "What are you going to be doing next?" And I said, "I don't know, because I can't go to England at the moment." And he said, "Well, we're just beginning to create an Egyptian State Radio operation, and we need people, young Egyptians, to start training would you like to join? And I said, I'd be delighted to join. And there's a very interesting woman who was my boss. And I started doing interviews and things like that. And then they said, we think we'd better give you an audition to see whether you're prepared to broadcast. And I did my audition, and they said to me, you sound like a five-year-old gone wrong. So I didn't do anything for a while. I prepared programs and so on. And then came the famous day, the end of the Second World War, the invasion, the landing in Normandy. And they were stuck, because there was nobody at that hour of the day, I can't remember what time it was, very early in the morning, to announce it. So they shoved me into a studio, put the microphone in front of me and said, start talking. And I never stopped talking after that. Well, that was a long time ago. As you know, that was 1944. And then I started doing more broadcasts, and I loved it, very interesting. And then my boss said she was leaving. It was also during the war. And I took over from her, and I started running this whole program, the whole English program for Egyptian state broadcasting. And I did this for about 7-8 months. And then they brought in another woman and asked me to train her to be my boss. She was another English woman who was a teacher and had never done anything in broadcasting. But she was a very decent woman, and I respected her. So I trained her to be my boss, and we did very well for about a year. And then she left. And once again, I was told to take over, and I did her job and mine for another year and 6 months. And then they brought me in an English woman who was the wife of an English Tommy, a soldier who was stationed in Egypt at the moment. She had never done anything on anything. But they asked me to train her to be my boss. So I said, I've had enough of this. So I went to see the head of Egyptian State Radio. I emphasized Egyptian State Radio. And he was an Englishman, because at the time it was being run by Marconi. And I said to him, can I do the job or not? He said, of course, you've been doing it beautifully. I said, well, why don't you give me the job? He said, we'll give you an assistant, but you can't have either the title or the salary. So I said, why not? And the answer was, I'm sorry, but we cannot give such a responsible job to an Egyptian, in Egyptian state radio. So I didn't even answer. I turned tail. I walked out of the building, and I haven't been inside that building since then. And that was 50-something years ago. So then, it was towards the end of the war, what was I going to do next? In the meantime, I had met some people in the BBC in Cairo, and they had said, well, we'd be very interested in having you in London at the BBC. And at the same time, Oxford said the war was over, and Oxford said, we're welcoming you back. So I decided, this is wonderful. I'll go to England, find out about the BBC, continue my studies in Oxford, and that'll be wonderful. But I had never been abroad. I was too young and the war had started. So I thought, no, let me try and see a bit of the world before. I had an uncle who was going to go to America, and he said, I'll take you along. So I went to a conference in San Francisco. Then he left, and I was on my own. And I thought, I'm going to see a little bit of the world. So I bought one of these $99 tickets where you can go all over the States for about 2 months, and stopping just everywhere. Sometimes I knew people, sometimes I didn't. Sometimes I slept on the bus, sometimes I didn't eat, but I just saw a little bit of the States. And I ended up in New York. And what does a tourist do in New York? Well, you see the Statue of Liberty and the Bronx Zoo and the United Nations. And in those days, the United Nations was out at Lake Success. And I sat in the Security Council chamber as in the visitors' part. And I discovered that what they were discussing, the Security Council, in May 47, the British evacuation of the Suez Canal. And I jumped, and I got up, and I said, I want to find a personnel officer. And I found the personnel officer right in the middle of the building at Lake Success. She still remembers the story. And I walked in, and I said to her, I believe in the United Nations so much, I'm willing to scrub floors for it. So she said, what can you do besides scrubbing floors? So I hadn't scrubbed the floor in my life, unfortunately. I said, well, I'm a broadcaster, and I speak Arabic, English, and French. Ah, she said, that's a bit different. We're beginning to recruit for United Nations Radio, and we think that you might fit in. So I said, all right, and I applied. But I hate to admit this, having been in personnel myself, but it took them something like 8 months to process my application. They sent it out 4 times. I was given odd jobs to do, but I didn't get it finally sorted out for something like 8 months. And I was just about to leave the country. I was on a tourist visa. And I had, in the meantime, cabled to the BBC and cabled Oxford and said, I'm not coming. And then suddenly they said, yes, we want you in UN Radio. And that's how I began in UN Radio. And then I was lucky enough to be sent all over the world. I've worked for UN Radio in many, many places. But the most interesting, and we were talking about broadcasters, I remember how the whole setup was planned and worked out, and the fights that went on, and I'm very intrigued, because apparently a lot of this is still going on, about the role of information and the role of radio in the United Nations. And one of our biggest fights was, are we going to get transmitters? Are we going to get the world to give us the independence and the authority to broadcast from the United Nations? And I'll always remember, I think one of my most exciting days in my life was sitting in front of a television, no, there's no television in them, in front of the transmitter in Studio 9, which I'm sure you know very well, announcing proudly, this is the United Nations calling the peoples of the world. I don't think they do it anymore. This never said that way. And this was a wonderful, wonderful feeling. And then came the other part of it. Because after you said that, then we had to say, and I used to say it in a very, very low voice, this transmission has been made possible by the Voice of America. Or you have been listening to the United Nations through the Voice of America. And we knew immediately how many radios were being turned off all around the world. All the BBC, all something else, or nothing. But the lovely feeling of this is the United Nations calling the peoples of the world is one of the most exhilarating feelings that you had. And this was the fight we had from the very beginning.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Lila Doss, a veteran reporter, address the International Association of Women in Radio and Television's biennial conference in Williamsburg, Virginia, in November of 2005. Doss is speaking about the beginnings of United Nations Radio and about her fight to spread information throughout the world.
Then came the fight. We had a wonderful proposal called the Stoner Plan. I don't know whether it still exists. No, it doesn't. Where we were going to have our own transmitters, and it was going to cost a magnificent sum all over the world, shortwave transmitters, of I think it was $1 million, and it was turned down. And there was a big debate right at the beginning, should the UN broadcast or not? Should there be radio? What's wrong? We have the BBC, we have the Voice of America, we have all the other stations. Why does anybody need a United Nations station? And the answer, well, I don't need to tell you the answer, you know what the answer was. And we couldn't convince the governments. And in fact, as we went along, we realized the pressures of the governments, how fantastically strong and, I was going to use some other words, on the way we broadcast. Now, for instance, we had such strong, rigid regulations for reporting. Do you know that when we used to broadcast United Nations news, reports of what happened in the Security Council, for instance, we were not allowed to use adjectives or adverbs. We could not say the delegate of X spoke eloquently, passionately, the angry delegate said this. No adjectives, no adverbs. Reporting from the United Nations in those days was like walking a tightrope with your hands clasped behind your back. We had to report each delegate in the same order. We had to give the same amount of time to each delegate. And the times a delegate has come to me and said, I spoke for 15 minutes and my adversary spoke for 1 minute and you gave them the same time. And I said, that's the rule. And we had to report also in the same order in which they spoke. Never an adjective, never an adverb, and the same amount of space. And when I do a media course, I give my students a Security Council report on some very explosive issue. I give them the UN transcript of the UN radio program, and then tell them to write it as if they were broadcasting from one side or the other. And it is fantastic to show them the difference from when one side is reporting and the other. They've been fascinated doing this, and I've shown them the use. We've talked so often, and you know it more than anybody else, of the use of the words. For instance, I remember when we were being so strictly trained on how to broadcast, we had a Russian who had just come in from Russia, our first broadcaster. And he started talking about, I can't remember, it was China, and one side was a clique and the other side was a group. And we said to him, sorry, we don't use those terms in the UN. And he said, I know, please give me a little more time to become international. And he did, and he became international. He became one of our best broadcasters. And then another thing, because we didn't do all the languages that now the UN can do, we didn't have the money for, we used to have correspondents who were accredited to the UN in the different languages and get them to do our UN radio bulletin in that language. And it was very, very interesting. The same correspondent would broadcast the UN radio program, the bulletin, very strict, very rigid, according to these lines. And then he would speak in his capacity as a newspaper or a radio correspondent from his country with a totally different slant on the whole picture, giving his side of the picture. And I remember there was an Israeli correspondent, and he was a person for whom I had enormous respect, and he would give the UN radio program exactly as it was, and then he would speak as his own country's correspondent. And his own people, some of his own people, got very angry with him. They said to him, you're being too fair. You're giving two sides of the picture. We only want you to give the Israeli side of the picture. And he said, but I'm speaking as a UN correspondent. They said, well, you can't do both. So he ended up simply being a UN correspondent and not doing the other side, because the other side felt that he was being too fair in doing the UN side. But this went on all the time. And then came the whole fight. Well, the fight never ended, because, for instance, some of the things that we had been trying to do, and once again, we didn't have the budget. I'm glad if you think that you have the budget to do the things you want to do. But I remember we were asked by the General Assembly to do a program on the situation of the Palestine refugees, and we were given the budget by the General Assembly to do that. The situation of the refugees in the occupied territories. So we prepared that program, and that program never saw the light of day. That program still exists, probably in the third basement of the United Nations. Why? Because when we prepared for this program, when we got the program ready, being United Nations, we had to be rigidly careful, and we put both sides of the story. Neither side was pleased. The Palestinians said, the majority of the General Assembly who had asked for this, said, we didn't ask you to put both sides. We asked you to do a program on the situation of the refugees in Palestine. And the Israelis said, you didn't give us enough space. And we had tried to do both while sticking to our instructions. And it didn't help anybody. It didn't please anybody. That program has never aired, and the film has never been shown. And then came the times, many times, when we were stopped simply because we had done something and didn't please some of the major powers. And I remember once I was sitting in my office, we were working on a film, and sometime you ought to see this film. It was nominated for an Oscar. It was about handicapped people. I was asking for a budget, I think it was something like $45,000 to put this film on. And I was listening to the debate, sitting at my office, listening to the debate in the budget committee. We heard somebody say, no, 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 this can only be done. We won't vote a budget for this. It should be done out of existing resources. So I jumped down and went down to the conference room. And I said, who talked about existing resources? They know perfectly well there are no existing resources. Each program we do has to have a specific budget. So they said, it's over there, it's the U.S. that has refused it. So I went up to the U.S. and I said, what are you talking about? You know there are no existing resources. Well, he said, take it from one of these programs we don't like. I said, like what? He said, like that useful booklet you did on the new international economic order. He said, that was a book we didn't like at all, and you didn't ask for a budget for that, and you could have taken money out of that to do this film. So I said, I'm sorry, but we're going to do the film anyway. And we did the film, and we got budget from other places, and that film was nominated for an Oscar. But this is the kind of problems we've had constantly. And there's another battle, was getting a budget for the UNDP, and you people who've been in the UNDP, the information program in the UNDP was a lost cause for a very, very long time. To get a budget to put information into a development program was an enormous struggle. And then on top of that, to put into that development program information which would consult the people who are being assisted and not just governments. And there was a whole issue involving that, talking to the people who were being assisted and finding out if that's what they wanted. And very often, it was not what they wanted at all. There was one case, I don't know whether you remember this or whether you knew about it, where the UN Development Program built a hospital. I think it was in Nepal. And nobody used that hospital. Nobody would go near it because they discovered it had been built on holy ground, which nobody would go near. Nobody had consulted the people. And this time and time again, I've talked about it for a million times, when the people have not been consulted and the program just didn't work. And this was another issue, the whole effort to try and get information into this area, or even to get it into a UNDP development program at all, and the constant fights within the UN. Oh, and then we're talking about the Voice of America, which at one point it was one of our main ways of getting the story across. And I remember overnight, it was under the Reagan administration, we hated anyway having to say this program came to you from the Voice of America, but even that was stopped. They didn't turn it down, of course not, but they put the price up overnight so much that we couldn't afford it. So then we went around begging, and I all remember going around begging, and not so long ago, calling one of the young Hammarskjölds in Sweden, because I knew him quite well. I said, please get the Swedes to do something about giving us transmitters, going around country after country, asking for the use of transmitters. And we never were able to get, until today, our own transmitters. We have never been independent. Nobody wants the UN to be really absolutely independent.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Lila Doss speak about her work in public information at the United Nations and at UN Radio. In this last portion of today's program, you will hear Doss refer to Waldheim. This is a reference to Kurt Waldheim, who served as the Secretary General at the United Nations from 1972 until 1981. Again, Ms. Doss.
Being an Assistant Secretary General, that was the most frustrating and horrible job in my whole 37 years of the UN career. Waldheim fired me because he'd done an interview, and he'd done a radio interview, and he'd said things that he regretted afterwards. And he called me up at 2:15 in the morning. I was in Vienna at the time, and he said, Lila, tell them I didn't say it. I said, I'm sorry, sir. I have my reputation with the press to retain. I don't know about you, but I have my reputation, and I can't. I can say you didn't mean to say it. I can say you were quoted out of context, but I can't do it. And he was furious. Then came another interview. He didn't do anything at the time, when he said something else and maligned the staff at a conference in Vienna. And nothing happened for a while. Then the staff rose up and said, if you don't take this back, we're going to rise up and have a staff movement and we're going to complain. So once again, he said, I never said that at all. And I suddenly saw that Waldheim had made a correction. He said, it's not true. I never said that at all. It was my information officer who misquoted me. And I was told I had to reply to this and say, what's it all about? I said, it's very simple. I have the transcript and signed by his name. What he had said was, The staff is overpaid, underworked, and irresponsible and inefficient. And he said this at a press conference when he had just been appointed. And I was his press officer in Vienna at the time. And he said that he'd said this. And that night, I had taken him the transcript as it was, as he had said it, and he changed it in his hand. It is said that the staff is overpaid and underworked. They claim that, and so on, but it was not what he had said. So when he called and he said, when the person who did this program should be held to account, I said, it's very simple. I have the tape. I have the transcript with your changes on it, and I have the tape. And he said, well, we've forgotten about it. I've forgiven you. I said, well, thank you very much. That's very nice. And then it was just after that, when he had tried to fire me and it didn't quite work, that his successor came in and asked me to take over a job which had nothing to do with public information as head of personnel. And I said to him, I can only do it on condition that you give me the authority to do an honest job. And the day I can't do an honest job, I'm going to leave you. He said, I beg you to try it for at least a year. Well, 3 months into it, I was about to resign. 9 months into it, I told him I'm not going to stay. And a year after, I resigned because I simply was not going to be forced to do things that I didn't feel right. And there again, whether it was information, anything else, the pressures of member governments were so strong, and I just wouldn't stand up to them. I stood up to them, but when I wasn't supported, I wouldn't stay. So that part of my life is the least interesting as far as I'm concerned, but what I loved and cared about tremendously was the information, and it's still going on. I'm delighted to hear Michel give us the impression that you're getting more leeway, more freedom, more authority to do work in the information field, but it's still not entirely independent as far as I can tell. And like everything else in the UN, as Hammarskjöld used to say, the UN is a work in progress, and it's still going to go on. Thank you.
Lila Doss spoke at the International Association of Women in Radio and Television's biennial conference. Doss currently teaches university courses and lectures far and wide on international affairs, communications, and multilateralism. For more information about United Nations Radio, please visit radio.un.org. In addition to daily news programming, UN Radio broadcasts a fortnightly women's program, which can be heard streaming online or downloaded in MP3 format, again at radio.un.org. For more information about the International Association of Women in Radio and Television, check out www.iawrt.org. For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Emily Falk.
Our email is wings@wings.org. Our website, www.wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, author of 36 Steps to a Gift Economy and Forgiving, a Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.